Hello, everybody, and welcome to the free preview of this month's episode of What a Cartoon Movie, all about the return of Jafar. And I am one of your hosts, friend of an evil parrot, Bob Mackey, who is here with me today, as always.
There's nothing in the world quite like a friend, and I'm your friend, Henry Gilbert.
Aw, and in case you don't know, every month we put on a little show called What a Cartoon Movie. They're normally 3 or 4 or perhaps even longer. Have we gotten to 5 hours yet?
4:45. Okay. That's our current limit.
One of these days, when Roger Rabbit happens, we'll be hitting 5 hours. But
oh,
yeah,
no.
It's a mega long podcast every month, only available at the $10 level on our Patreon. But every month you get to hear the extended free preview of the history section of that podcast. And after that, there's a full discussion with clips of the entire movie. And this month, of course, we're talking about the return of Jafar, the first Disney direct-to-video feature that started off a long, long line that lasted about 20 years, and this is the very, very first one.
So not only do you have the history of the first direct-to-video Disney sequel, but you also have, like, we'll talk about how Robin Williams was replaced. We'll talk about the outcome of this. We'll talk about the folks who made the Aladdin TV series making a movie accidentally without playing. And I'll make a lot of allusions to Jeffrey Katzenberg.
So if you enjoy listening to this and want to hear the rest of this episode and also get access to all of the other episodes of What a Cartoon Movie, please go to patreon.com/talkingsimpsons and sign up at the $10 level. You'll get access to the rest of this podcast, all the other episodes of What a Cartoon Movie, and also access to everything behind the $5 paywall as well. And that includes all of our limited miniseries, the upcoming Talking Futurama Season 2 Part 2 will be there, and everything we've done behind the paywall for the past 3+ years will be available to you instantly. That is a ton of podcasts, over 100 bonus podcasts, and hundreds of hours, I dare say, of content waiting for you there.
There's so many great movies we've done. You know, if you head over to patreon.com/talkingsimpsons, you go through back about 6 months, you will see our 5 months ago, we just posted the full Aladdin What a Cartoon Movie for anybody to listen to. So you should check that out too, not just to catch up ahead of this Return of Jafar talk, but also to hear what you're missing out on. And when you jump into that back catalog of, I think, 100 hours of podcasts now, we've done tons of other great Disney films, such as The Great Mouse Detective, A Goofy Movie, not to mention varied films like Akira, Space Jam, Spider-Man Into the Spider-Verse, Beavis and Butthead Do America, and so, so many more, on top of all of the $5 stuff. So if you're a $5 person, you are missing out on even more awesome content that me and Bob have done over the past 2 years. So please sign up at $10 a month at patreon.com/talkingsimpsons to hear all of it.
So thanks for sitting through this intro. We'll let you get to the free preview of this month's episode of What a Cartoon Movie, all about the return of Jafar. Doing research on this, I found there's not a ton of information. There's basically 3 interviews with Tad Stones about this because it made them a lot of money, but it was not a prestige thing. People were not like doing documentaries about it. No one's really wanting to look into this. And then like 59 other direct-to-video things followed
Good
this.
Lord.
So it wasn't special. It wasn't very special when people wanted to do retrospectives. It was just like, yeah, it's one of a million of these garbage things you put out. But yeah, that's I found all I could, but it's mostly coming from Tad Stone's interviews. And another reason why it's hard to find info on this is because this project was just fed into the Disney TV animation factory, which was running at like high capacity by 93-94. It was like we were now like 4 seasons into Disney Afternoon proper, and like with several more years to come. So like it was just a functioning machine with several creative people, and everybody who worked on this, they were all TV animation people at Disney.
Not only they had gone beyond the just the 65 episodes in a year that then come out the next year. Like the productions were like multiple shows because they had their afternoon shows. They were starting to dip into like Disney Channel originals plus shows for ABC or CBS, like the Little Mermaid show.
Yeah.
Like those were like 13 episode productions. Yeah, they were doing Gargoyles and Aladdin at the same time, like the production of globally out of multiple studios. And then on top of that, you have like this prestige thing going down to, you know, the best people in Disney feature, make a film that looks better than anything. How can a TV show possibly compare on that time and budget? Like, it, you put them side by side, even a child can notice, like, this is different.
I definitely did. And to provide more context for this, like, we can talk about what was happening to Disney in 1994. I would say, dare say, they were approaching the height of their powers. May of 94 was, like, literally right before the release of The Lion King, a movie that no one expected to be, like, the biggest thing for them in the 90s, beating Aladdin, which was then their biggest hit.
Yeah, Lion King was so huge. Like, 94 is the most hubristic moment of Disney. Like, so I just did the whole audiobook for Disney War. Yeah, 94, like, the tensions are high between Katzenberg, Roy Disney, Michael Eisner, and, you know, Frank Wells, I believe, is still, he's not too far from death here. Did you know, by the way, Frank Wells, his helicopter accident where he passed away, he was in a group of people that left in two helicopters. And so one group went in one helicopter, one group went in the other, and it was like 50-50 if you died in that choice just based on which helicopter you picked. In the safe helicopter, Clint Eastwood.
Wow.
In another world, a flip of the coin, Clint Eastwood could have died that day and Frank Wells could have lived.
It's true, like, Frank Wells is a real danger liker, right?
Oh, yes. Yeah.
I'm not victim blaming here, but if you're a rich man, just, like, sit in a safe chair somewhere where nothing can hurt you.
But they don't feel alive then.
It's true.
You know? Hey, at least he's not hanging out on David Geffen's, you know, yacht.
It's true.
Somewhere like Katzenberg loved to do.
So, yeah, feature animation is exploding. 90s are huge for Disney, and obviously, Disney Afternoon is going strong. It started in 1990 with Tailspin being the first show. I can't stand when people say DuckTales was a Disney Afternoon show. It was grandfathered in, and I'm pissed off that people keep saying that. It started in 1990 with Tailspin. There, I've said it. So we have Tailspin in 1990, Darkwing Duck in 1991, Goof Troop in 1992, Bonkers in 1993. I'm sorry. And then Aladdin in 1994, Gargoyles 95, I think, like, Mighty Ducks and Quack Pack 96. It's going great for Disney in the 90s.
Oh, God, the Quack Pack.
So, like,
yeah.
65 new episodes of stuff every year, except for Gargoyles, which eventually reached that much.
Yeah, like, they had to. We talked a ton about that in our Gargoyles Part 2 1, about just how hard it was for them to be demanded, like, late, like, hey, you gotta just do 52 now. Like, we should have ordered 65 from the start, but we played it safe in your first season. Now we need those other 52.
You better get cracking on those. We need by next fall. So yeah, Disney has a lot of shows on Saturday morning too, like you said, Henry. So along with making episodes of Darkwing Duck and Goof Troop for the syndicated block, they're also making 13 for CBS. Sorry, ABC has, like, Goof Troop and Darkwing Duck, and then CBS has their own Little Mermaid series that's not part of the Disney Afternoon, and then later CBS will also get exclusive Aladdin episodes that will later be folded into the syndicated run. So, like, Disney is everywhere and very successful on TV. And like I said before on earlier podcasts, almost all of my Disney knowledge comes from, at least in my earlier years, comes from this TV stuff because I had access to it. I didn't have to go out and buy the $20 clamshell release of Pinocchio or whatever to watch Pinocchio.
Yes, the class divide from us is no more clear than on the Disney shows, because I did watch all the Disney TV shows, but not that we had the whole back catalog, but like, if it came out, if it was outside of the vault and I could go to Target with my mom and ask for it, I could probably convince her to get it.
This is an investment, mother.
So yeah, we had that. And also, like, just the tapes of, here's five Mickey Mouse cartoons. Just here they are. Watch those.
It's a steal. Yeah, I mean, my fiance, Nina Matsumoto, who did the cover for the Disney Afternoon collection, the video game release, like, she is like me in that she didn't watch a lot of movies as a kid, or have access to a lot of movies. So she knows Disney stuff mostly through the television stuff. And that was a very smart thing that Eisner did in the 80s by saying, you know, let's make good TV animation. There's a market here and no one is taking advantage of it.
And when they started that, like, there's you talked about that in our DuckTales one, like the newspaper article that was like, they're selling out to Japan and they're giving away all the, they used to be known for great animation and now their animation's gonna be terrible.
That article was just like, can a Japanese person draw Donald Duck? I'm skeptical.
It was like they'd been doing outsourcing of animation for decades by the late 80s, but I guess it was news to most people.
I guess Disney had never done it. I mean, they had done it with with like gummy bears and stuff to that point. But I guess the idea of Japan or another country touching these classic characters was just blasphemous.
Well, and it was seen as a lesser thing. It's like, sure, Hanna-Barbera and Filmation outsourced to other countries, but Disney's better than that. They're a pure American made thing. I mean, definitely that go also went into the whole like American made versus buying foreign idea too.
We were very mad at Japan in that time period.
And so I guess, you know, the direct to video thing that would come later is like just an expansion of that, of just like, oh, now it's even invaded the feature division.
So a misnomer that I hear a lot about this movie is that it was going to be a theatrical release, you know, produced with budget, but that's not true. I hear that a lot, and I don't know why, because it's very easy to debunk.
Totally, yeah. If I ever saw it, I would have just thrown it out immediately. It's like the second, if you know anything about TV production, you watch this and you're like, these are three TV episodes. Like, this is it's not a movie.
It's not like a Rescuers Down Under situation either, where it was like quickly pulled from theaters and then became a video release. It hit theaters at some point, and it was, you know, developed with a theatrical budget and theatrical animation. So that's a different case entirely.
Oh, Rescuers Down Under looks like it cost 10 times what this cost.
Yes. So this was news to me. So the Aladdin TV series was commissioned before the release of the movie in 1992. So given that the launch of the movie and the Disney Channel launch of the TV series are just a little over a year apart, that makes a lot of sense, because this was news to me that, well, this part wasn't news. So, you know, before Disney Afternoon would launch their shows in September, Disney Channel would always have run like maybe like 9 or 10 episodes like in the spring.
That happened like with Bonkers. We got to hear that was part of the sign of its troubled production, that they just put out like 5 Bonkers on Disney Channel, and they're like, uh-oh, no.
And like things with like Goof Troop and Darkwing Duck, they always were on Disney Channel like 6 to 8 months before they hit the fall schedule. So this was true of Aladdin as well. So Aladdin debuted on the Disney Channel like 9 episodes in February of 94, which is like a year and just a few months after the movie came out in theater. So the movie is November of 92. So that's just what, like a year and 3 months? Yeah.
Wow. That's, I thought Return of Jafar was the debut of that more Aladdin content.
No, that totally surprised me because, so at this point, to give context, Disney Channel was a pay channel. You needed to pay for it. So before Return of Jafar launched, kids with the Disney Channel had seen 9 episodes of the Aladdin series.
Wow.
They had and knew about New Aladdin. I didn't. This was like the first New Aladdin I had seen.
I'm jealous of those kids. My family could have easily afforded it, but I could convince my mom to buy a clamshell tape, but paying more for cable each month, that was more of a dad decision. He was on the cheap side of things. So
Disney Channel deserved to be free anyways. So yeah. Let's just put it on basic cable, everybody.
It would happen eventually, but not then.
So the story of Return of Jafar, it's not that it was developed for theatrical release and then bumped down to video. It was developed for a TV release and bumped up to video, because Return of Jafar was initially developed to be sort of like, let's say like the DuckTales 5-parter, where they would air that all is one thing on like the Friday night, and then the next Monday, bam, it's when the series starts. Like, that's what Return of Jafar was going to be, part of that system that they were doing, where just like, oh, you can watch the DuckTales 5-parter or the Tailspin 4-parter or the Darkwing Duck 2-parter, and then bam, following Monday, you get all your new episodes.
I thought it was lame that Darkwing got bumped down to just a 2-parter for his.
Yeah, like, and like, and then Bonkers got a 1-part. Like, everything after that was like a Goof Troop 1-episode, Bonkers 1, and then Gargoyles, what, like 5? And that was...
Yeah, that was a big... Yeah. Released as Gargoyles the movie, probably because of the success of Return of Jafar.
That is the next one, is Gargoyles. So 94, this, 95, Gargoyles, 96, Aladdin the King of Thieves. From 97 onwards, there's multiple releases every year.
Not to skip ahead, but totally then they saw the success of this. They're like, what could also be a movie next year? Just say the Gargoyles is, But yeah, they'd have these premiere events. Sometime I remember Darkwing, I watched it on like an evening slot. It was like around TGIF kind of time.
Is it called like Darkly Dawns the Duck or something like that?
I believe it was. Yeah. It wasn't just like an event episode, but they were origin episodes. I always liked that on Disney Afternoon, they cared more about having a first episode that explained everything than, like, you know, Inspector Gadget never did that or whatever. I like having a good first episode, even though, you know, that would go against their whole rerun everything forever attitude, because whenever the two-parter that was the first episodes showed up, it did confuse me a little bit if I missed them the first time. Like, I didn't see the premiere event for Tailspin, so when I'd see part one and two, I was like, oh, this is the first one. Okay.
I have to assume that they were inspired by the Tiny Toon Adventures video, How I Spent My Vacation. It doesn't come up in my history at all, but that was, we did the history of that over a year ago. That was like setting the precedent, like, this can be a thing. You can put a higher budget animated version on video and then people will flock to it.
Absolutely.
To a thing they can get on TV.
100%. Yeah. Like, it, yeah, to go back to How I Spent My Vacation real quick. Yeah. When that came out, you could sell in the VHS market of your back catalog of movies. You could maybe even package together like three episodes of Tiny Toons. Here it is. But they never made an original video animation in the OVA Japan style until that one. And that really was like Spielberg and his company innovating on it. And like that the Warner at first didn't know if like would kids actually get their parents to buy a $20 tape of stuff they can see on TV for free. Turns out, yes.
Yes.
And definitely after reading Disney War, to know like the kind of competitiveness but also business relationship that Katzenberg had with Spielberg, I feel like Spielberg probably having that success of Tiny Toon Adventures must have lit a fire under them a little bit to be like, you know what, we could sell an original thing on VHS as well.
I think so. It was really an animation arms race in the 90s between Warner Brothers and Disney, and I dearly miss it. I really miss them just amping up the budgets to take each other down.
I know. Now technically they're all fighting with like Netflix, Warner, and Disney, and I guess to another extent, Fox through via Hulu. They're all making original animation to fight each other, but it seems like they're all being made like as cheaply. The arms race is not about spending money or having the fanciest thing.
They all look like Bob's Burgers for some reason.
Why must they? I just watched the first, because I wanted to know. I just watched the first episode of that Lower Deck show, the Star Trek show. I didn't know from reading the credits, and it's fine. It's a fine show. It's fine.
I've heard it's inoffensive, yeah.
Yeah, but when I read the credits, the pilot is written by the co-creator of Solar Opposites.
Oh.
So they didn't just say like, hey, let's make Rick and Morty. They're like, who's in the Rick and Morty orbit can we hire to make our Rick and Morty?
Can we borrow a Rick and Morty writer? Just launch this thing? Yeah.
Maybe Justin Roiland was like, well, I'm too busy for it, but this guy's free.
Sounds like it.
Anyway.
But yeah, the two people assigned to lead this project were Tad Stones and Alan Zaslav, who previously were, they developed and ran Chip and Dale Rescue Rangers, and of course Darkwing Duck, and we can get into more about who they are later. I've got little bios on both of them, although we talked about Tad Stones before, and he's my best friend, because I bought several pieces of art from him, and original, my wedding gift, of course, that I'm not married yet, but I thought I was going to be, but my fiance, wife-to-be, has a drawing of Splatter Phoenix from Tad Stones.
Oh, that Splatter Phoenix one is so great. I mean, you, and you're marrying Splatter Phoenix.
It's true.
Well, so,
we're getting the duck surgery soon.
But that's such a cool drawing that he did.
It is.
Was great.
Drawing that character for the first time in like 30 years. So
I love when you can ask somebody for a long time.
Can't just ask for Launchpad like everybody else.
You're a guy in your 30s. You want Launchpad, don't you? Come on.
So Stones can't remember who came up with the idea for the direct-to-VHS sequel, but he thinks it was either the head of Disney Animation for TV or Jeffrey Katzenberg. But he thinks it honestly doesn't matter because it was a sure thing. The Little Mermaid TV series was a success, so it felt like that was like, can we do this, or will this dilute the power of our movies? It turns out it didn't. So Little Mermaid was the experiment, like, can we make a TV version of the movie? Yes, we can, as long as the quality is high. So the Aladdin TV series was an obvious next series. You're not going to make a Beauty and the Beast TV series. There's nothing there.
I guess the bigger question, like, did these things dilute their brands? Like, I think they did a little bit, but in the 90s, I wasn't as engaged in the animation world, but I definitely know that it was an argument even then of like, you're ruining these things. This does dilute the properties. Like it makes these classics less important, especially once the sequels started engaging with non-new Disney Renaissance stuff.
Once we get like Bambi 2 and all that crap.
Air
like
Quasi.
Oh, jeez. So yeah, I mentioned earlier that this Return of Jafar thing was going to be like the pilot movie to kick off the series. And what happened was Katzenberg, I believe, was screening the opening footage. They're getting footage back from Australia. Mm. And the movie, of course, talk about it soon, but it's just split down the middle-ish. Like the first half is Australia, the second half is Japan. And Katzenberg and I believe the president of Disney TV Animation saw the opening set to Arabian Nights. And the animation is very good there. And they're like, you know what? This could be something more than a TV project. Why don't we make this a video thing? And that's where this came from. Just like seeing that opening footage. And I think this movie gets a lot of, it borrows a lot of Aladdin Valor, the movie Valor, by like, let's quote this song. And I think it's kind of like a placebo effect. When you hear the familiar music, you're like, the animation seems better, doesn't it? So
yeah.
I feel like there was some sort of placebo effect happening by hearing Arabian Nights, seeing similar scenes and thinking like, it's just like the movie.
That, you know, that was my experience just rewatching it, because the opening set to Arabian Nights, even you're watching somebody on a horse riding somewhere like it, and it's these panning things. I mean, it is hitting me that like, oh, this doesn't look half as good, but I was like, you know, this is kind of like Aladdin. And then it slowly is like bled out of you, that feeling of nostalgia as you watch it. But it starts strong. And I mean, especially like you play one of the movie songs. Like, I'm surprised they didn't play more movie songs in this.
Yeah, like they do quote a lot of the movie songs in little bits. And like one of the songs feels like an inversion of a popular song from Aladdin.
Hell yeah.
The Jafar song is like the evil version of Friend Like Me.
That's the best song. I love it.
I was listening to it on the way over here.
Like Jafar is so sassy and I love it. Like,
and this is not off topic. The Aladdin live action movie came out last year and I saw that with Nina. We both drank like a fishbowl full of liquor and that helped. But I have to say, like, I was lukewarm on it when I saw it. I was just like, eh, whatever. I wasted 2 hours. Now I hate it after watching Aladdin again and seeing this. I'm like, Jafar is boring. And this is Iago's movie. This movie is all about Iago rehabilitating him. And Iago is not even a character in that movie.
Yeah, he squawks or whatever.
He just goes, yeah, blah, blah, blah.
Yeah,
like, he just repeats things. Were you afraid of people seeing a talking bird and saying, well, this is stupid, I'm leaving?
Well, that movie had so many problems where they just had to, like, be convinced, I guess we can't just hire white people.
Yeah.
But your movie.
Iago rules. Gilbert Gottfried rules. Just put him back.
I also don't like they gave Genie a girlfriend. I'm like, I don't want Genie.
Oh, yeah, that crap.
Yeah, Genie is too camp to have a girl. Like, else, you know, just have him be silly in camp. It's Friend Like Me. Honestly, my favorite part of the Friend Like Me is when he just starts beatboxing. It's like, this is the one part where it feels like Will Smith is trying to make this his own song instead of just singing somebody else's song, you know?
But yeah, but watching this made me realize, like, oh, yeah. Yeah, like I had not seen Jafar in a while, and I'm like, man, Jafar is great. I mean, he's just Scar. He's just like the stock Disney villain from this era, the campy gay villain,
the
evil gay man.
Finally, an evil gay man.
But like, he's great, and like the Jafar in that movie is so boring. He sucks. Doesn't even like camp it up,
which is too bad, because that evil Jafar guy was just in a seemingly kind of boring Charlize Theron like Netflix movie, but he gets to be gay in that. And I'm like, come on,
I don't think it's
Jafar be gay here?
Don't think it's the actor. I think it's just the direction they were given, like, let's make this very bland and make people forget it's a cartoon.
Well, definitely. I mean, that's which is too bad too, because like it was directed by Guy Ritchie, who I think he's good at doing live action cartoon stuff. I think, is he a bit of a lad? Sure. Yes, but
he's not having a go with a bird, he's having a row with a wanker.
I like his movies. All right, he made the only movie where I liked Gerard Butler in something.
Oh wow, is that possible?
Yeah, it's Rock and Rolla.
Okay,
actually, that movie's actually all right.
So Stone said on the record, like, if a weaker studio had animated that opening sequence, there would not have been a future of direct to video stuff for Disney.
Wow.
And I will say, like, Disney Australia is totally awesome. Check out our episodes about Goof Troop and Bonkers. I think their work looks better in those episodes than it does here. I feel like they were really constrained here or really stretched thin. Like, I did not see as many of the flourishes I expect. And I think all of the best animation that I associate with them was spent on Iago. Like, all the Iago animation in the Australia half is just so beautiful and very observational and very fluid and so many flourishes. But I don't see, like, as many of the strengths in this movie.
And they save a little good stuff for Genie, too.
They
do some good stuff with Genie. But I agree. There's in the stuff that's obviously Australia, like where they're all their mouth and tooth stuff, they're so good at
drawing like a little circle around the iris. That's like such an Australia Disney like little thing they do. It's weird.
But the problem is that they're so good at all the cartoony characters they did in all of the Disney Afternoon stuff. But your human leads in it, they can't do those things. Like, I think they had very strict rules on, like, well, Aladdin can't do a wild take, or Jasmine can't do this.
They're not as grotesque as like Lucky Piquel or Goofy. They can't like, or Pete or whatever. They can't move in those same ways. But like the Japan stuff, I was expecting it to be a lot stiffer than the Australian stuff. Japan does a great job, but I think the highs are higher for the Australia sections, but Japan has like more consistency throughout.
Yeah, that's exactly how I feel too. The Australia stuff, when the Australia stuff doesn't work, I think especially they like struggle with like Jasmine. Like, they're really not good with her.
Yeah, there's some funky Jasmines in this.
Like, those go low, and that's why like in for the WDDAJ, they're much more steady, and they especially like Walt Disney Japan is so good at women. Like, they are really good at drawing well-acted, pretty, or at least, you know, attractive women in Disney style too, but who can do action and do cool stuff? So, but their Genie though is just more solid. Like, he can't go as wild.
Yeah,
like that kind of spirit of spontaneity that really comes through in Australia, you don't see that as much with Japan. So those are the downsides. But I at least do love the Japan parts, how steady the quality is.
Yeah, like the models are also like very solid. The effects animation is great. Very, very pretty stuff. So Stones is developing this movie, and he's like, it's got to be about Iago. He is like one of the best characters, if not the best character in the original movie. We have access to Gilbert Gottfried, and we need to rehabilitate him in order to make him part of the series. Like, it's weird to go back and watch the first movie, because I think Iago's a good guy, having seen the animated series for much longer than the movie. Like, oh yeah, Iago's one of their pals. Yeah. What's he doing with Jafar?
Iago, again, my favorite character in it. I loved my little stuffed Iago toy. I slept with him like every night for a lot of my childhood. And yeah, especially I remember his like very hard face. Like, it was like a puffy body and then a hard beak.
It's a weapon.
Face.
It's a weapon to kill your brother with.
But I really did love Iago, even though I knew he was the villain. So when it hit me, you know, pretty quick into the movie that Iago was going to be the good guy and he was going to be a good guy regular, I was so pleased. And they're really lucky too that Gottfried, who, you know, he's not like a mega star, but he's definitely a bit more famous person than the regulars they had in voice acting for their shows.
I mean, we've seen the documentary. He'll do anything for money.
Yeah, absolutely.
And he loves being Iago. And I have like, I just assumed like, oh, I never watched his stand up or whatever, or saw his SNL stuff. So I just assumed like, yeah, funny voice man. But over the past 5 years, I've been listening to his podcast, and I have so much respect for him as someone who appreciates like weird pop culture stuff, and I've learned so much from his interviews with people that I never even knew the names of before. Everyone who sung like a one-hit wonder in the 70s has been on his show. And I've learned all about the guy who sang the Pina Colada song. Rupert Holmes, there you go.
I gotta catch up on that. Yeah, God, I mean, look, does Gottfried put his foot in his mouth? Sure.
Yes.
But look, I really like him too as a performer.
He's a good-natured old cuss.
I mean, I remember hearing him on a podcast where he's telling his life story and how one of his earliest jobs was on The Cosby Show. And unlike a lot of people that got a leg up from Cosby, you know, who will go like, look, I don't know about that stuff. I don't want to talk about it. He was just like, no, fuck it. Like, he was probably like, he was making some very off-color jokes about it, but he was like, fuck Cosby.
I'm sure he was doing a bad Cosby impression in his voice, too.
Maybe. but anyway, yeah, I loved Iago, so seeing him get to be the lead is great. And that's such a smart thing, like, because he's, especially if you can't get Robin Williams back, which I'm sorry, cut ahead there, but to get you need some funny guy as the core of your show, like, to really bring people in for this comedy.
And I will say, please check out the documentary Gilbert. It's probably streaming somewhere, but I watched it when it was new, and it's just like, I never knew he was such a, like, a sweet man, a very guarded but sweet man.
I love that he, like, that clip that starts it of him on Howard Stern, where they're like, wait, you're engaged? Like, you have a girlfriend? What's going on? And he's just mad to even, like,
And I like seeing all, like, the hotel things he steals.
Yes, yeah, that he's the cheapest guy in the world.
He takes, like, Megabus to his concert. His stand up gig, sorry.
It's so funny that he's on a fucking mega bus and just like, you're famous, don't do. But I think and he seems like a pretty nice dad too.
I love Gilbert Gottfried. So yeah, he's in the movie, and he's this is the Iago movie because he's the most interesting character. And you're right, Henry, I feel like without Robin Williams, they're like, we have to double down on the one famous comedian that we have. So let's do Iago, like the strongest Iago story we can tell.
Yeah, totally. And well, also, you know, every character, the movie is really well written in that every character has a full arc that is completed, and so except for Iago. Like, Iago doesn't have an arc because he's just like the shitty sidekick of the mean villain. Like, so finally giving him an arc, that's one story that was left untold. Like, Aladdin already, it's a problem at the start of the movie where, like, well, it's Aladdin. He's, like, you know, happy and stuff. He's not a street rat anymore. He lives in the palace.
And okay. I guess Iago is just pulled into the lamp at the end by Jafar, right? He's like, you're not going anywhere.
Yeah, then they're just like, oh, yeah, well, shut up. You shut up. Like, that's our last shot of them in the movie.
And I live with an evil parrot, so I like seeing movies about them.
clearly, though, the genie did not pitch them very far.
No, he
pretended to.
He should have thrown them in space. I mean, we should really be blaming the genie at this point. But so the original had a $28 million budget. Return of Jafar had a $3.5 million budget. And
That sounds big for a TV episode.
That shows you how expensive those episodes were. I imagine they were like $1 million per episode at least to produce.
Yeah, I bet so. Yeah, 65. I mean, they're still making a profit. The syndication rights just in the first year probably cover that 65, and then you can rerun them into eternity.
They were like dumping $60 million a year into just like a new series. That's nuts.
Yeah.
Oh man, to be alive again back then. The head of Disney Feature Animation, Peter Schneider, was worried sequels would tarnish the Disney name.
That guy seems like a douche.
You know, this made $300 million, so he's like, well, the subject is closed.
Yeah.
So
that's
true. This movie made $300 million. It cost $3 million to make.
Wow.
This is their future for the next 20 years.
I mean, well, they
15 years, let's
they
say.
They so primed the pump for this because they, by the 80s, was the whole battle of like, oh, the Disney vault actually is opening up and they're putting the classics on VHS. They said they never did it. So that lended so much prestige just to that like white clamshell box. So by putting a cheaper thing in the same box that had all that prestige, they sold just as many as they did a Pinocchio, but for a cheaper thing.
And without Robin Williams.
And without Robin Williams.
I bet Katzenberg was happy, like, we don't need you.
I proved it, buddy. Yeah. I love that speech where I think it was the Golden Globes where he won, Williams did for Aladdin, and he named everybody but Katzenberg. And that's just such a great, like, Katzenberg is a dick. Like, he sucks. Like, every time he came up in that Disney War book, I'm like, God, this guy
nobody
sucks.
Likes him, and he's still yelling at us for not watching Quibi.
And it's so funny all the times in there where Eisner in the news would call him like the golden retriever or just mock him. I actually have a new theory, Bob, that I think Smithers is a Jeffrey Katzenberg joke. I think.
Oh, really? Who would have worked with him?
James L. Brooks.
Okay, so, where? At Paramount?
So actually, with Barry Diller in charge of Paramount, James L. Brooks, worked with Barry Diller and Katzenberg.
And Smithers.
And Katzenberg a lot on Terms of Endearment.
Oh, shit.
And
Barry Diller. Yeah, sorry. I'm sorry.
Yeah, yeah. And Barry Diller, who is, you know, he is a Mr. Burns type, except he is just openly gay. He's a gay man.
I forgot about that.
Everybody would joke that Katzenberg was his little lapdog who would just do all stuff. And he's this, like, shorter guy, super obsequious to Barry Diller. And so I think it's on the Samson and Delilah commentary, they say like, oh, I thought Smithers was based on Barry Diller assistants. And now I think that they're talking about the Barry Diller assistant, wow, Jeffrey Katzenberg.
I buy it more than he's Richard Sakai Smithers.
Yeah, I mean, definitely I think Richard Sakai sounds like he's a good assistant.
I think maybe some of the writing was referencing that, but not the like the initial concept for the character, maybe.
Yeah, I have a feel someday they're gonna come out and be like, none of us liked Richard Sakai. He sucks.
Who is he? What does he do? So Tad Stones is kind of down about this movie, actually. He's like, I don't even own a copy. Damn. I think we weren't given enough time to develop a strong story. And he prefers the next movie a lot more because Robin Williams is in it. And also, he didn't think Japan did as good of a job as Australia. Mm-hmm. So in the next movie, he did something different. So what he did was, instead of splitting the movie down the middle where it's like, okay, Australia, you take this half, Japan, you take that half, he divvied up the scenes like Australia gets the more like character acty scenes and Japan gets the more like effecty action scenes. So playing to the strengths of the studios instead of just picking arbitrarily where to split the production down the middle to trade off, like you get this content, you get that content.
That's really smart. I mean, it's unfortunately couldn't do it with this one, but at the time the machine was just like, you do an episode, here's 20 minutes of this. Like, so I can see why they had to make a more just specific, like here's the cut, this half and that half. But I guess in the couple years in between, they finally were able to get more specialized and just assign out scenes instead.
Yeah, and Tiny Toons was lucky enough to get like all TMS, like one studio throughout. But this one, I know it was split because they're in production on the TV series. These studios are already making episodes at the same time. So one studio can't make episodes and also 69 minutes of animation on top of that.
I think Tad is right that the... Japan didn't put as much work into it. Like, if you compare their section at the end of this movie to what they were doing in the first episodes of Gargoyles, like, the A-team was on those Gargoyles episodes. It feels like the B-team was on this one.
I think so, yeah.
Though I still think they do a really good job, but I get Stone's disappointment. And I think King of Thieves works better than this movie as a movie because it's not intended to be aired in three episode chunks originally, so it tells a cleaner story.
I will have to watch it again, but when I was watching it last night, not taking notes or anything, that's for the next watch, I didn't really feel like there were three distinct points in which you can cut the story up, but maybe that was just me. But I do know that Return of Jafar was never divided and aired on TV.
It was
a Disney thing, like, no, you gotta buy this shit. Maybe Tiny Toons will put that movie on TV, but we're not doing it, we're Disney.
There are
some conspicuous fades to black.
Oh yes, that's what's...
But it didn't feel like it divided the story neatly, like there'd be like a cliffhanger every 20 minutes or whatever.
Yeah, I mean, well, the biggest one to me is in the last third where, like, once Jafar shows up, that feels like, oh, this is a Jafar episode. You basically got zero, almost no Jafar up until the last third, and then he shows up. But yeah, it's more that there's clear, here's the commercial breakpoints. I get the feel from it that they made it thinking, okay, where would commercials go if we put this on TV? Here's where they are. But then once it sold so well on VHS, they're like, this will never be on TV because this has to be a thing you buy.
They edited it then to make it seem less like a TV show.
Yeah, though also, like, I think King of Thieves has a little bigger budget than this, too.
Yeah.
Like, there's some bigger moves in it, not just the Robin Williams budget.
I was thinking more of, like, the Futurama movies where, like, they are definitely four episodes, and it's so obvious because they do not run like movies at all. They're very odd.
I hate to say that the Family Guy movie handled that packaging better than Futurama did, but they really did.
I think It was like a backdoor way into TV that I didn't realize was happening. I'm like, why are these movies so oddly paced? And then I found out that's actually a new season of television you didn't know about. So I have a quote from Tad Stones about this production. So, quote, when it was in production, Jeffrey realized what a good job the Australia studio was doing in the first half. But there was a sequence that didn't move the story. It was just there for fun, and it got cut suddenly, and there was more Japan than Australia in the movie. The climax was all Japan, and it didn't have the punch of the earlier stuff, and it's just weak because of that. I would have loved to have seen a different mix there. So Tad was saying the Japan studio wasn't where it eventually would be in terms of, like, how good they were at animation. I disagree, but that's what he was saying. He's like, they would become a much better studio, but at this point, they did not have the chops to do the finale of this movie.
Yeah, I mean, I don't agree with that either. But I mean, he was seeing it day to day, so he worked on it. But my opinion on just quality is, like, you watch there, I think they really got good on Gargoyles, but when we did their Darkwing episode that was theirs, it ruled. Like, yeah. they were the best Darkwing animators. There were a couple, like, you know, oh, that's a flub for TV kind of thing, but there's really great. And I watched a couple of their tailspins. I was like, yeah, really good too. Like, there's but maybe their big flourishes, you know, they got better over time. After Gargoyles, they became like the best animators, I think the best animators of the direct-to-video stuff. Like, they were the kings of it.
That's it! I've had it! I hate to be dramatic, but it's time for me to fly the coop. Terrific! Fine! I'm drawing the line before I wind up in a parachute. I was a fool to let you run the show. I'm cutting you loose, pal! Look out below! Arrivederci! C'est la vie! Hope all goes well! Looking out for me.